about her latest project. So I'd like to welcome my guest today, Josephine Pembroke. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, good. So we're obviously the Museum of Soho on Soho Radio, and we were really drawn to the title of your show, you know, The Working Girls of Soho. And so this is a cabaret show.
Yes.
You know, so tell me a little bit about it. You know, what was it that inspired?
What inspired me was that I was sitting next to Giles Brandreth at dinner, very luckily, and I said to him, I said, oh, I'm going to, you know, I am a singer on and off. I've been a podcaster for the last 10 years, and now I'm back on the stage. Everyone started podcasting, darling, so I stopped. And I sat next to him and said, oh, I'm going to start singing again. He said, you can't just sing, you know, you've got to do something that's interesting. You've got to create a show about some time in your life. So I kind of, you know, went back home and started thinking, well, I lived in Soho in the 1980s, which is a bit like saying you lived in Berlin in the 30s or Paris in the 19, you know, Belle Epoque. And I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, this might be quite cool for some people, you know. I mean, for me, it's just part of my life. But, you know, it's just, you know, I've got some stories to tell, put it that way.
So, because you were part of the cabaret act Pussies Galore, right?
Yes, I created it.
So,
yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that, because, you know, for the listeners.
So what happened was I got kicked out of drama school because they said I couldn't act, and that made me so angry. But I thought, I'm going to go out and do something. I have to be, I've got it, you know, this is it now. You know, it really motivated me. I can't become an actress because being an actress is all about rejection. I've got to do something which I'm in control of. And I think being a performer, a singer, you've got more chance. You can go out and get the gigs. You can go out and make things happen. And you can write the songs and put an act together. So I was literally traveling around. I bought this old vintage BMW, and she was called Beige, a 2002 for anyone into cars. And I was wearing a black leather cat suit, and I had a blonde bob, and I was driving around and thought, oh my God, I'm Pussy Galore out of Goldfinger. I'm a Bond girl. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start an all-girl Bond band, and I'm going to perform all over London. And I found my pussies in Soho, because that's where I lived at the time.
I used to know someone called Louise Ness, who...
Yeah, Louise Ness was in my band, yeah.
Was she?
Yeah. She was pretty, yeah.
She was, yeah.
Yeah, that was the name of her in the band, and I found her in Madame JJ's, obviously. Yeah,
I think that's probably where I met her. I can't remember now, it was too long ago. But we had this, we talked about doing some music at the time, but never happened. But I remember her really well because we went up a few times and talked about it. And I actually wrote a piece of music, which you can't write a piece of music called Beat Girl because of the John Barry, you know, because of the film.
Yeah.
But I did anyway because I thought I'd try and write some theme piece for her or something. This was much more around the Lenny Beige era. So when's this? 95, 96?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, after Puss. Well, Pussies was, finished about 93, 94. Yeah, so just after, yeah.
So you were ahead of that then?
Yes, we were pre-burlesque and we were pre-kind of Spice Girls. We were 1992. We were at the height of club raving, which is really hysterical because we were like in our mid-20s and we weren't real ravers. But we started up a nightclub called Night of the Living Ultra Vixens, which was not in Soho, I'm afraid. It was in Mayfair, which is very Pussy Galore, I think. And it was a club night, and it attracted really interesting people, like Jefferson Hack used to come along, and he called us born-again clubbers. And the great thing about it was we could perform there every week, so it was like a kind of captured audience. One time, we got so much publicity, and one time we were in the Evening Standard, and we said, this is a club where women will seduce men. It's the other way around. And we had that had been in the Evening Standard, and the next Thursday, we had 400 young men trying to get into the club. It was incredible. It was like literally like, it was great. We're just taking money. And then we thought, oh my God, we've got these men. Now we've got to kind of give them a performance. It's like, it was more than just, we had to really, you know, do something extraordinary. So I kind of got bananas on stage, and I sort of, you know, did these crazy things to kind of try and sort of entertain them, as well as being a singer and a cabaret artist.
There must have been there's that tiny little gap between calling your act Pussies Galore and then inviting 400 men coming along, that's called regret, probably, as well.
Yeah, exactly.
As well as opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. But then luckily they never came back again after the night, because they didn't, obviously there was only about four women there.
I'd have loved that. Not the being the sad side of my half of the species, but the what you were doing, I would have loved that.
Also, it was a time of grunge, so nobody was doing glamorous stuff. Mm. So, you know, it was like and it was, as I say, pre-burlesque, that there wasn't sort of glamour. And we used to say things like, our club, tonight you've all got to come in black tie to people, and, you know, just things like that, just to kind of get people to kind of dress up again. You know?
Well, we may have been similar orbits in a weird kind of way, but I was a journalist at that point. But what was strange, one of my friends said, when all the Britpop stuff happened, and alongside that the lounge stuff became more mainstream, I was already way into that. All my music was like that. That's
what I love the Karminsky brothers. Yeah,
and doing soundtracks and music and things like that. And my friends were like, "Oh, you were doing this already, you know?" And I was like, "Well, I was, but it was kind of a bit weird when it became, you know, like when you love something so much, you don't actually want everyone to."
It's so annoying when they come mainstream, because then it's like everyone knows that your secret's out, and it's not your dirty little secret anymore.
You know, suddenly everyone's like going in and buying easy listening albums and sampling them, and I was like, "Well, I've already got quite a big collection of this stuff." I had a lovely all of that period stays with me. And about 3-4 years ago, I've got a 15-year-old, and so she was like 12, and she quite likes all the soundtrack stuff because I do it. And the KPM All Stars did their final gig before Alan Hawkshaw died at the British Library.
Mm-hmm.
And I begged, stole, and borrowed some tickets, so we went. And I said, "You must come, because I don't think we'll see this again." You know, the full orchestra with them doing everything, and we were right down the front, and she's right in front of Alan playing the organ, and they're all doing their stuff, and they're doing all the classics. And I said to her afterwards, "What did you think?" You know, and I said, "Did you enjoy it?" She goes, "Dad, if you didn't enjoy that, you haven't got soul." And I was like, "My job is done."
She sounds the coolest girl ever.
No, she's brilliant. She's fantastic. She would love. She loves, you know, Taylor Swift. Fine, but she's playing Fred Astaire to her friends, saying, "You've got to listen to this. This is really interesting."
Fabulous.
She loves Cole Porter.
Oh, well, she's got such good taste. Well, what I did was I found, because it was when tapes existed, so I found this old 70s tape of sort of, I don't know what Bond it was, but what I did was I wrote songs on top and then got them sampled, and then I got things like Diamonds Are Forever and made it into a sort of, and then I put club beats, that sort of behind the backing, so my sound was sort of nightclub, but with mixed with, you know, Goldfinger, Diamonds Are Forever, and then other songs I wrote about being pussies galore, with this kind of real mad 70s funk behind me. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm super. We just watched the Bond music documentary the other day, and I'm super privileged because of my job. You know, I've met a lot of people and get to know people, and the Bond thing is always like, every time it comes up in some form. I had a cup of tea with Sean Connery once.
Ah.
I played at the first Jubilee concert at Buckingham Palace. I was in charge of all the screens and doing all the films and everything. So during the sound check day, Shirley was there, and she was doing Goldfinger, and she had the full orchestra and everything. Because it was a sound check, they had a grand piano there, and the only person who was using the real grand piano was Tony Bennett. So it was there, but it wasn't plugged in. So I was like, "Well, who cares? No one's going to hear me." So with the full BBC Symphony Orchestra or whatever, and Shirley doing Goldfinger, I just sat down and joined in on the piano. So I'm sitting on the stage, and my team were like, "You're not really supposed to do that." I was going, "But who's going to hear it? Who cares? I'm just not doing this, you know."
The great thing is, you've now performed with Shirley Bassey.
Yeah, and also I've worked with Nancy Sinatra quite a bit.
So yes,
and the first time I worked with Nancy, we were in she's great, and the first time we were in Hotel California doing an interview for the BBC, and I said, I started playing You Only Live Twice, and And she said, you'll have to shift key, but if you want me to sing along. So like, I transposed it and she sang a little bit of that. So I feel like I've played with two of the Bond stars. That's
good. You have.
And no, that's like, it's only cheating. They're not real. It's not like in any kind of professional capacity, but it's just the best music in the world. I love all that.
Yeah, same here. Well, before we came on air, we were saying how much we love John Barry, weren't we?
So that was your background. So the show Working Girls at Soho, which it looks like you've been working on for a while and taken to, it's been to Edinburgh?
Yeah, took it to Edinburgh this summer, yeah, which was brilliant, yeah.
That's not specifically that era, that's your background. So tell me a little bit about the Working Girls at Soho show.
So the Working Girls at Soho, what happened was I thought, right, so I had this idea. So then I really did lots of research. And the good thing about this podcasting is I've really learned how to research. So I spent quite a long time finding women, which you will have heard of, but they're not mainstream yet, as you say. So obviously there's people like Teresa Cornelis, who was the first ever club runner in Soho and was a woman. And then there's Mar Merrick, who was the most successful club owner in the 1920s. She had about seven different clubs in Soho. Talk about the 43 Club. And then I talk about an all-girl gang of thieves. They were called the 40 Elephants Gang, and they thieved all around the parameters of Soho, but in their night time they'd go and hang out, you know, in Soho and snort Brilliant Chang's cocaine and hang out with Mar Merrick. And then I talk about I talk about the Windmill Girls as well. I've got some good stories about them, and, you know, about Mrs. Henderson, how she opened it. And then I talk also about Marvellous May, who was the most successful whore in Soho in the 1950s. And, I mean, there's so many different women I talk about, you know. I mean, and then I talk about the strip clubs in the 60s and the clip joints. And then also, I mean, my show can change in size and how big and how many people I talk about. But also I talk about Fiona Richmond, you know, at some point, you know, the time that she... to promote, because Paul Raymond bought the Windmill in 1974 and he wanted to promote it, and he was going out with her and he said, right, I want you to be Lady Godiva. I don't know if you heard this story. So he hired a horse, and she, there's a picture of her outside the coach and horses on the horse. All she wore was a long blonde wig and thigh high boots, and she was naked. And then she went down Piccadilly, and then she went she got arrested, trotting down Piccadilly, I'm not joking, she could ride. And then she was taken off in a black Mariah to Vine Street Police Station, let off with a fine and a big wink. And the man who'd arrested her liked her so much, he invited her to his silver wedding party, the policeman. Can you imagine? I mean, those are the days. They thought she was so audacious. Mm. Mm. So there's some very, very interesting women who... Oh, yeah, and Muriel Belcher, obviously, I talk about. Who had the Colony Room. You know, I talk about quite a lot of different bohemians. Henrietta Morris, Molly Parkin. I mean, honestly, the list, I have got more women. You know, I found these amazing women who were interested in they all followed the cult of the clitoris. And they used to go to the Palace Theatre all the time. So that's, again, on the edge of Soho. Well, it's not on the edge, because actually you do count Leicester Square as Soho if you're really, you know, proper Soho. The cult of the clitoris worshipped this sort of dance movement, which was a bit like Isadora Duncan. So it was all about women being free. But I love the way that clitoris was like a sort of word that it was sort of, now it'd be quite a shocking word to say, but then it was obviously just probably a medical term.
Yeah, most of the men didn't know what it meant.
They wouldn't. Well, hopefully they would have found it if they heard about it.
Yeah, it's interesting that Mar Merrick has come up twice today, because I was interviewing someone earlier who's written a book about the Soho bebop scene from 45 to 50. But he was setting up Soho as, you know, the demi monde and the way it's history. So she came up in that. That's quite funny. I don't suppose there's probably anyone else who's come up with. Who's had Mar Merrick mentioned them twice in a day?
But Mar Merrick, obviously, she died in 1932, after doing hard labour. Yeah. Aged only 57, 58, because she was she went to prison five times, and then the fifth time, because she'd been collaborating with a policeman, she was made to do hard labour, and that actually finished her off. That gave her terrible flu, and she died, which was very sad.
So what's the format of the show then? So
the format of the show is I don't mention all these women, obviously, in every show, because otherwise it'd be too long. But generally what it is it's me singing songs in character. So I sort of, the songs I sing, I sort of act like I sing Love for Sale, and I act a bit like a sort of prostitute, and I sort of try and seduce the audience. And then, you know, and then the first song, Whatever Lola Wants, I've got a whip, you know. So it's sort of like, I'm sort of getting into different characters, and then I start talking about the women. I don't talk for too long because there's nothing worse than that. So I only talk about 1 minute on each person. And I also mix it with a little bit of, like, well, I didn't know I was a comedian until I did this show. Because now I find I'm sort of beginning to ad lib and have really fun with the audience and really kind of go places. And I love it when people shout at me, or I love hecklers. I love it to go all a bit out of control. And then I can sort of, you know, and so what happened was I didn't know I was funny. And then everyone started laughing when I was performing. And I was really lucky when I went to the Fringe, because the MD of the Fringe, who is a woman, came to see my show. And afterwards she wanted to have a chat with me, and she said, Josephine, you're a comedian. I said, what? I'm not. I'm a singer. She said, well, loads of people can sing, but you're funny as well. She said, so milk it. So it's really fun. So I'm sort of funny, and I tell stories, and I sing jazz classics, show tunes, and they're all women. They're all kind of women characters, obviously. And they're often ones that are quite, there's some that are quite sad and moving, but some that are very funny characters.
A good opportunity to play something, actually. Let's have, you mentioned Love for Sale.
Yeah.
Why do you like that song so much?
Well, because it obviously is about, you know, a working girl. And I sing it in a very, very slow way. And the idea is that I'm seducing you, and my heart's broken because of the job I have to do.
Still unspoiled, love that's only slightly soiled, love for sale. Who will buy? Who would like to sample my supply? Trip to paradise, love for sale. Let the poets pipe of love in their childish way. I know every type of love better far than they. Been through the mill of love. Oh, love, new love. Every love of a true love. Love for sale. Appetizing young love for sale.
That was Love for Sale by Ella Fitzgerald, written by Cole Porter. You know, I love Cole. I've actually decided over time, I grew up in a pop world, really, but I've decided personally that Cole is the greatest songwriter of all of them.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I do love Burt Bacharach, but I think Cole Porter for lyrics and tunes.
Well, he did both, so that's one of the great things about Cole. You know, nearly everyone else was writing in duos, you know, not one.
It's brilliant. And his songs can be adapted so well and made into all sorts of things. As you say, if you hear an Ella singing a Cole Porter song, she'll make it totally jazzy. And then you could hear somebody else doing it very sort of 30s or someone else even doing it now. You know, you can, it's very, they're classics, total.
I've seen a man sing Love for Sale and it became, you know, an outtake from Rent and it was beautiful, you know. It was something in its own way. I can't have the show and not name drop all the time. That's literally why I'm here, right? So that's my thing. But I've already mentioned my daughter and I mentioned Nancy Sinatra and we've mentioned Cole Porter.
And Shirley Bassey.
And Shirley. But there's a and story that brings all three together. I was at Nancy's house, if you can believe it, doing it in Palm Springs. And there was, with my daughter, she was about 8 or 9. And there's a big picture on the wall, a painting of Frank. And my daughter looks up at it and says, you know, completely, you know, innocently, "Oh, look, there's the man who sang, 'Well, Did You Ever?' with Bing Crosby in High Society." And Nancy goes, "That was my dad." She goes, "No, it was the man who sang, 'Well, Did You Ever?' with Bing Crosby." You know, I said, "Z, you know that." But, and she goes, "How the hell does she know that?" I was going, she loves all those big musicals. And, you know, if you ask her, she can do, she kind of knows about 20 songs by Berlin and 20 songs by Cole Porter that she knows they specifically wrote. So, which is quite unusual for a 10-year-old, but she just...
How old is she now?
She's 15, but still listens to all that stuff, you know.
Yeah. I'd invite her to my show, but I'd say it's 16 plus, but I imagine your daughter's quite mature.
She's mature, yeah, I'm not worried about her. No, she'd probably love it, yeah.
Yeah, because I find young women, I mean, men are fascinated by it, but women are totally empowered by the show. Because also, because I'm a woman of a certain age going on stage and being outrageous, which most people at my age are sort of starting to wind down. And I'm doing the absolute opposite.
I was quite inspired by, you know, what Tony said about what you'd said about your career and stuff, that... I feel like as I've suddenly got into my mid-50s, and I'm sorry if you're not in your mid-50s, but I was...
No, I am. I'm late 50s.
Oh, okay. I suddenly was like, you know, I want to go and do something with some of my music. I've always done it for myself. I really have. I was actually really about the making the programmes and all that. And so music was just the thing that I'm really passionate about. And suddenly I'm like, you know, actually, my stuff's really good. Someone should hear it. I know it's impossible, but, you know, it would have to be, you know, small scale. Like, but maybe I'll go and do something because I feel like, you know, why not?
And I think we've got to live. You know, we've had so long when we haven't been able to live and everything's against us now. But it's all the more reason for us to go out there and do things.
So as a performer, what was, as someone who likes to go out and perform, what was COVID like for you?
Well, it was actually good because I was writing the show. And I was really lucky because I was in the countryside. So I got madly into gardening and did all those lovely things. But I had long COVID, so I felt quite shit, actually. Had to rest every couple of days. Yeah. I'd sort of, you know, do some mad gardening or go for a walk and then have to lie down for about 6 months. So, yeah. And you've just had COVID, poor you. And you're not feeling brilliant.
Oh, I'm all right getting there.
Good.
So I love Bacharach too. I met Bacharach.
Yeah. I'm so envious.
Met him. You never guess where I met him in a million years. It was in Soho, but where in Soho?
I was going to say in a gents' loo.
No, in Madame Jojo's.
Oh, fantastic.
Can you imagine?
Oh, it's like a dream come true, but Bacharach in Madame Jojo's.
Well, they just put out, you know the Bacharach instrumental album with all those beautiful versions of things like The Look of Love on? Mm-hmm. I've forgotten what it's called. It's the really famous one, which I played to death. And they reissued it or something, A&M. So they had him over and they held a party for him. I think he was doing the Royal Festival Hall or something. So they held a party at Madame Jojo's of all the places in the world.
Fantastic.
Maybe that's where I met Louise, actually.
It will be, yeah.
It was very weird because I was drunk and he wasn't. So I probably made an idiot of myself. Oh, dear. I noticed also that you've mentioned, and I had already come across the fact that you had been an early, you know, you're a bit early with your going into the lounge thing there, but you're also early going into podcasting, I noticed. And,
I run longest running all female podcaster. It's 11 years old. It's 11 years old, my podcast, which is really quite old. because no one knew what it was. And for years, people say, I don't understand how to play it. I don't know how to do it. I said, just go on your computer and press play. You know,
When I was at the BBC, we did, I produced the first ever live internet broadcast, actually. Which was...
Wow, that's like saying you're the first person to speak ever on BBC or something.
Well, not quite, but it was quite mad. It was NetAid, and there wasn't the bandwidth to try and put a programme up for, but we decided to do it. Of course, it's live streaming it now would be easy and amazing. But there was a point where basically there was no one, exactly. They were having your problem there, like, who's listening and, you know, how do you do it? And I remember sitting in a meeting with Jenny Abramsky, head of the audio and music at the BBC, and the discussion was whether they should stop funding bbc.co.uk because it's too expensive doing this digital thing.
They were going to give it up on the website.
And then this guy come in and said, well, we've done an experimental podcast within our time with Melvin Bragg, and we had 20,000 downloads, and literally everyone in the room went, 20,000? And it was hilarious because I think In Our Time now has something like, you know, 8 million unique listens a month or something. But they were really shocked. It was so early on and you just couldn't get anyone to listen.
People were really
wedded to traditional media. So it was brave of you to go in early like that.
I know. but it was very hard to make money and still is. And so I used to kind of teach people how to podcast. That was one of the things I did on the side because they didn't know, like people like Sainsbury's Magazine and, you know, kind of, quite good, you know, all these different magazines would come to me and say, we don't know how to do it, how do you do it? And I'd sort of help show them how to produce them. So it was quite good.
You radiate the confidence of someone who knows what they're doing and everything. But I wonder, you're saying, but you, an experience, but it's interesting because the people, like myself as a journalist, I was shielded from the worst of the world because I did it early enough that social media didn't exist and all that kind of stuff. Would you like to be, you know, front facing with a million listeners now? Are you able to cope with?
Yeah, I'd love it.
More. I've gone the other way.
Oh.
I won't be able to cope with it now.
Well, I wonder how many people listen to this. Sorry.
Yeah, well, sorry. Very few, I should imagine.
Well, that's a relief for you.
But this isn't controversial, is it though? So I'm discuss whatever we're talking about, but I'm not really sitting out. I'm not doing a political program. When I was at the Times, I was doing news, hard news. And it was really hard to get through to the news desk. So if anyone did get through to you, I mean, like after Princess Diana died, we had a week of people calling up the news desk. They've got through and you'd pick the phone up and go, hi. And they go, are you a journalist? And I'm going, yeah. They go, I'm going to kill you, you effing flipping. Da, da, da,
wow, da. Interesting.
What would now be done on Twitter, you know,
yeah, something like
that. But
yeah.
I'm amazed when I see Laura Koonsberg Emily Maitlis, the misogyny and the hatred they get for basically doing their job online. It's unbelievable. I don't know how they can get up in the morning and do it. I actually felt sorry for Liz Truss this week.
Yeah.
She's not my politics at all, but she needs to be on suicide watch.
I've noticed they do it particularly to women. I felt the same. And I think, you know, as much as I don't care about our politics, I do think that it's also being a female, I think they do pick on them more, you know.
They do. I mean, it's really clear they do.
Yeah.
I think with Liz Truss, for example, you know, like literally I've got no sympathy for her politics and she's made
them. Well, no one has. That's why she's going.
But, you know, it was, wow. I mean, she was literally being what we would normally put down as bullied nonstop all week.
Yeah.
And it was like, this is so shameful. Can you imagine? I mean, literally everyone. So imagine having a whole world ripping you like that. How strong do you have to be to survive that? I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know what the aftermath of people have for them.
Yeah, she's still an idiot, but but I've just done it there, haven't I? But you know, she's not listening to this, I wouldn't imagine, so it'll be all right. But so do you think there's more, the kind of show you're doing, where are we in London for being able to, are there more venues, less venues? Are you finding it an easy ride?
Yeah, I find it, it's, the thing is, I really like a good venue. Like the other night I did Phoenix Arts Club and it was such a good venue, I can't tell you, to perform at. So well run, and you know, they gave me a technical rehearsal and they did proper lighting and they did the sound check, you know what I mean? And oh my God, it was so wonderful to perform there, dressing room. But more often than not, I'm in a loo getting changed, being shoved onto a stage, you know, don't know my arse from my elbow, you know what I mean? I performed at Jerry's the other night and he's offered me a kind of monthly residency. Probably it's going to be the second Wednesday every month. You can go to my website to find out because it's going to be released soon. I'm going to speak to him next week. Jerry's on Dean Street, obviously, the basement. You know, there's just much more chaotic and the doorbell rings all the time and it was, you know, rowdy drunks. And but, you know, you just every time you play, and then you can play in some places where it's like a pin, everyone's silent, nobody laughs, you know. So it's every time you perform, it's different, you know. But I mean, now, though, I've got now I might be getting a band. At the moment, I've got a pianist, John Crawford, who is absolutely brilliant. He's famously the best Latin pianist in London. But I'm, and a few of my songs have a Latin sound, but I'm going to try. I met Carl Charity, this famous horn player, came to my show. And I think it'd be really good to have this sexy horn in because it's very sort of, wah, 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 wah. With, you know, it's, I mean, as you know, if you like lounge, it's all about horns and trumpets, you know. And he was saying you need a sax and a trumpet and, you know. So I'm looking into that because I think it would make it fantastic. And then I could perform. He was suggesting upstairs at Ronnie Scott's and, you know, there are all these different places. It could expand me more in the kind of jazz world. Thing is, I do want to keep talking about my Soho girls as well. I'm not totally jazz. I'm sort of show busy, bohemian, loungish, cabaret glam. Yeah.
So you've listed Eartha Kitt as music to play today.
Yeah, I went to see her in the Palladium when I lived in Soho. She came down from the ceiling on a chaise longue. And then she had two gorgeous black men dancers. And then when I also lived in Soho, I saw Liza Minnelli at the Palladium. That was fantastic, you know. Also, when I was the PR for the Soho Jazz Festival, that was one of the most fun jobs I ever did. Working for Peter Boyzo above Kettner's. It was like, it was just such a riot. And my job was presenting. I had to go on stage at the Palladium and introduce Buddy Rich, the drummer. It was one of the highlights of my career. I was on stage. Yeah, it's really exciting. It was such fun. And that was before the Atlantic Bar and Grill. I worked at Dick's Bar, actually. I worked for Dick, who is a friend of mine, who obviously you know because he's really famous. And he also was the barman at Colony Room Club. But before that, it was called the Strand Palace Hotel. And they gave the basement, which is now where Crazy Cox is, to Peter Boyzo. And that was, it would been shut. It was, when I went, it was a 70s disco. It was totally low ceiling, sort of a floor, which was kind of like lit up, you know, and all these soft seats. And it had been closed down for 10 years because someone had been shot in there in the 1970s. It's just so exciting, isn't it? So what happened was they said one of your perks of being the PR for Soho Jazz Festival is you've got 10 nights staying in the Strand Palace Hotel. I remember this band called The Sandals who were around at that time. I don't know if you remember them. And they came to my hotel room and completely changed all the furniture around. You know how you always, you know, sort of like hanging out with the Beatles in Help, you know.
Yeah, well, my first job in TV was working on the chart show on ITV, and then I went over to the BBC and I used to produce things like Glastonbury and the Mercurys. And I had a 6-year period of mayhem right through the middle of Britpop. So
Because you're slightly younger than me, so you were more in the 90s, mid-90s
in that period.
Whereas I was having a baby then.
Wow, blimey.
But I arrived in Soho in 1982, so you were probably just a little boy then.
I came to Soho... I'm not allowed to mention this because Tony always tells me off for mentioning the Beatles. But my first trip to London with my girlfriend when I was 16, we went straight to Soho because that's where McCartney has his office.
Yes, I remember.
Soho Square.
It's still
there.
Is it still there? MFL or whatever it's called.
MPL.
Yeah, that's
and
it.
I literally, can you believe this? I'm 16, we've come to London and went there. And who should come around the corner? I've been in London 18 minutes in Soho. So Soho has always been associated with me.
But I think when you're young, things like that happen to you. I've got my theory. Is your kind of, your mind is much more open to sort of things, you know, and as you get older, you sort of get more shut down and you're worrying about life. But when you're young, just fabulous things happen to you like that. I do believe it happened to me a lot, that sort of thing. I came to London and I met The Clash and they took me out for the night.
How fantastic. When was that?
When I was 16, I came down to London. I hitchhiked down to London. I went to the Embassy Club and I met Mick Jones. And he said to me, oh, do you want to... And I said, oh, hello, my name's Josephine. It's nice to meet you. And he said, do you want to come out with me tomorrow night? And I said, yes. He said, I'll meet you at Pimlico Station at 7:30. So my friend, I'd never even hardly been on the tube, you know, because I was this girl from Yorkshire. And he took me on the tube and hid behind a pillar. And Mick Jones arrived in a black cab. And then we went over the water. We went to this massive studio where they were playing a song called London's Calling. And I was the first person to hear it. And I remember they passed me a joint. And I hadn't really ever smoked dope before. And I had to smoking dope with The Clash.
We didn't play Eartha. We should play something by Eartha. What are you going to play by Eartha?
Well, it's one of the songs I sing as, again, I Want to Be Evil. And I sing this after I've talked about the 40 Elephants gang.
I've posed for pictures with ivory soap. I've petted stray dogs and shied clear of dope. My smile is brilliant. My glance is tender. But I'm noted most for my unspoiled gender. I've been made Miss Rheingold, though I never touch beer. And I'm the person to whom they say, you're sweet, my dear. The only etchings I've seen have been behind glass. And the closest I've been to a bar was at ballet class. Prim and proper. The girl who's never been cased. Well, I'm tired of being pure and not chaste. Like something that seeks its level. I wanna go to the devil, wanna be evil. I wanna spit tax. I wanna be evil and cheat at jacks. I wanna be wicked. I want to tell lies. I want to be mean and throw mud pies. I want to wake up in the morning with that dark brown taste. I want to see some dissipation in my face. I want to be evil. I want to be mad. But more than that, I wanna be bad. I wanna be evil and trump an ace just to see my partner's face. I wanna be nasty. I wanna be cruel. I wanna be daring. I wanna shoot pool. And in the theater, I want to change change my seat just so I can step on everybody's feet. I wanna be evil, I wanna hurt for lies, I wanna sing songs like the guy who cries. I wanna be horrid, I wanna drink booze, and whatever I've got I am eager to lose. I wanna be evil, little evil me, just as mean and evil as I can be.
I Want to Be Evil by Eartha Kitt. So what's the future hold then? What are you, what with the, for the show?
Well, I'd love, I mean, I'm going to get this mini residency in Jerry's, which is great, but it's, the stage is the size of a postage stamp, so I can't have, the last show I did at Phoenix Arts last week, I had two dancers with me, which are Pussies Galore. You know, that's why it was saying Pussies Galore are back. And they danced with me for about six different numbers. So I need somewhere like Soho Theatre, or, you know, I'm looking for a sort of a theatre in London where I can perform it regularly, you know. If you know one. What about the Leicester Square Theatre? That little one.
So the question is whether even Soho is the right place to do it. You know, probably somewhere more east would be.
Oh, right. Interesting.
I think. But I don't know. Yeah. I haven't think about that.
Thing is, I lived in Hackney before it was fashionable, and I left before it was fashionable.
We're just thinking about moving out for the first time. I live there now. I am dialing in from Hackney.
Right.
My family have been here for like 250 years, but I've kind of just feel like doing something different for a change.
It's
part of the, not midlife crisis, but the, can we move things along a bit, do something different?
Yeah, great. It helps not having any money to give you drive.
And so you're going to try and take the show, you know...
Bigger, better,
Yeah, making it bigger. That seems to be the job, isn't it?
Yeah.
Brass section first.
The brass section is so sexy. I just love it. Wow.
You need... I'll tell you what you could do with. You need... the some of the young people I meet who are... there's loads of them from the music schools and Brit schools and everything, but they've got really, really high standard musicianship, but they would have, you know, you'd be able to get a brass section there. You'd also be able to get fairly decent drummers, but, you know, at the young age, when then, you know, they'd be prepared to do it, you know, which is what you want.
Yeah, and they're enthusiastic, which is what you really want.
It's the funding issue as well, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
The arts are not particularly well funded at the moment, so.
Nope.
So have you got another choice of music for us?
Yes, it's Sophie Tucker, Last of the Red Hot Mamas. And Sophie Tucker was the first person to persuade Ma Merritt to break the law. And that's when she started really making money, because those really, as we know, as we remember those terrible licensing laws. Well, they were quite good fun when you had to, you were closed at lunchtime, then you opened again at, you know, 6, and then you closed again at 11. So nightclubs, they were very, very strict, and you had to be served food. You didn't have food, then you couldn't be served drink, and all these, and then that you could be, and then you could be closed down by 12. And so Sophie Tucker came to the club. She's a New York Jewish, really outrageous singer, comic singer, and she was really famous then. I mean, she's still quite famous now. And she came to the club and she said to Ma, "You ain't ever going to make any money if you stop serving liquor at this hour." And Ma opened a bottle of champagne and never looked back.
Sheep, necker, and jelly beans, lend me your ears. Though you think you've been petted, don't be silly, forget it. Dead flapper and baby band, fall me to tears. What do they know concerning love? Come to me for your burning love. 'Cause I'm the last of the red hot mamas. They've all cooled down but me. Flapper band, say what do they know? Come get your hot stuff from this volcano. I'm an overheater, try and beat it. Hotty, totty, hot and hot. Now it may be snowing, but when I get going, oh baby, I'm hot. You can't keep your collegiate charmers. Their loving isn't worth a dime. Away up in Alaska where the natives freeze, an Eskimo left my hut in his PVG. 'Cause I'm the last of the red hot mamas. I'm getting hotter all the time. I don't want to brag, but in my hotel suite, a dozen firemen will overcome by heat. A Scotsman wants to marry me, the dear sweet self. He thinks with me around, he'll save a lot of coal. I met a movie star who's famous for his past. I gave him one kiss and singed off his mustache. A funny thing happened, I nearly died. I sat down on an egg, got up, the egg was fried. I'm the last of the red hot mamas. They've all cooled down but me. I don't pet and only neck 'em, no sir. I'm a mama who loves to wreck 'em. I can make 'em sizzle, make 'em fry and frizzle. If you want to know the truth, I can warm the cold ones, give the old ones back their flaming youth. I was born in the hot Bahamas. Right now I'm in love and pride. Others pet and kiss and hug and don't know what it's all about. Say, when I kiss men, they feel they've had their tonsils taken out. 'Cause I'm the last of the red hot mamas. I'm getting hotter all the time.
That was Last of the Red Hot Mamas by Sophie Tucker. So, Josephine, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. I hope the show goes well. I hope you find your band. I hope you find your residency.
If people want to contact me, they go to radiogorgeous.com. And then that's usually where I have, like, info about shows coming up, or if you want to contact me to be on the mailing list, that would be a really good idea. And then I can sort of, you know, keep you informed about, keep you abreast of what's going on. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
No, it's been fun. There was quite a lot of name dropping there, wasn't there, between us? So I think we did quite well there. That was like, you know, you can hear the thumps all the way down the street.
Yeah. Well, if you get to our age, you've met quite a few people.
It was really lovely talking to you, Josephine. Good luck with the...
Thank you, Des. And please, everyone, come along to the Working Girls of Soho, radiogorgeous.com, Josephine Pembroke. I want to be told I'm brilliant all the time. I've got problems.
Don't be so needy. I know what you mean now. I'm the same.
Any performer is. I mean, it's, you know.
I stopped worrying about it so much that
but you killed yourself.
I just thought, you know, in the end, it's like it's...
Oh, no, I don't... You know, the thing about the fame and everything, actually, it's the doing it is the fun. You know, it's the journey. I know it sounds corny, the bloody journey instead of a destination. There's never a destination. Life's just constantly a journey, and I'm really enjoying getting back on stage, and I'm having a ball.